We are in Revelation chapter 3. We are on the sixth of the seven churches in Asia. And as we've looked through these things, there are only two that have all sorts of commendations, but no negatives. They receive encouragement and so on, but they are praised for their faithfulness. And that was the second one. And then also the which is Smyrna, and then the second to the last one, which is Philadelphia. Now, persecution, which we're going to talk about a little bit as we deal with the city of Philadelphia, as well as the church there, abounds for Christians. We live in a place and in a window of time where we don't suffer really any overt persecution. The stuff that we deal with in this country, frankly, is very subtle and frankly not very troubling compared to what they deal with in many countries around the world. These days, Christians are being killed. They are being killed not just individually, but in groups. And it's kind of interesting. If it were almost any ethnic group, it would make the news. But we're dealing with a genocide-level extermination of Christians in some countries, and the news is silent about it. Folks are imprisoned. They are driven from their homes. Their churches are burned. And in many countries, they are not allowed to rebuild. That is part of the Islamic system in that theoretically, if they're going to abide by the book, which they don't always do, that Christians are left alone as long as they pay an additional tax. You can exist as long as you pay an additional tax. You cannot evangelize Muslims. You can evangelize other groups. You can evangelize within your own community, but you cannot evangelize Muslims. It's a capital offense in a great many Muslim countries to convert from Islam to anything. And if you are responsible for bringing that about as a Christian, then you will often sacrifice your life as well. This is one of the reasons why in places like Saudi Arabia, the churches, you know, it's kind of statistically, it's 100% Islam in Saudi Arabia. But in reality, it's not. And there are little groups far smaller than our group here this evening that meet in apartments and in homes and in secret. Little groups of 3, 4, 5, and 6, maybe. So they can't give each other away. They don't even know each other's names. Not their true names, so that they can't give each other away. And if their buildings are destroyed or damaged, they cannot repair or rebuild them. In this country, sharing the gospel can cost you your job. It has been known on a few occasions to land you in court for harassment. We are not in a Christ-friendly world. And like I said, we have lived in a window and in a place where Christianity has generally been considered noble, praiseworthy, and so forth. And for us to suffer what Christians have generally suffered in the past is a novelty for us. But understand that as far as the history of the church is concerned, it's the norm. This has never been a Christ-friendly world. The church there in Philadelphia, so let's go ahead and get started as far as our slides are concerned. Philadelphia is, let's get my information over here, is, of course, the city of brotherly love. Our large city in Pennsylvania of the same name is derived from this, and there's actually several different Philadelphias in the ancient world. There's one in Syria. There's several other places, and it means literally the city of brotherly love. Compared to the other churches that we have here in Asia, this was the new kid on the block. This was a new city. During the time of the writing of the book of Revelation, the city was less than 300 years old, which when you consider how old some of these others were, is nothing. It was actually, and let me carefully explain my terms. It was a missionary city. Now, it was started about 187 B.C. Was it started by Jews seeking to promote the worship of the true God? No, it was not started by Jews. And of course, the gospel of Jesus Christ had not been propagated yet, had not been given yet. So what sort of evangelistic zeal? Islam hadn't come along yet. That hasn't come along for centuries. In the ancient world, starting around in the 300s, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, the Greeks had this policy of what we call Hellenization. In other words, we are going to spread Greek culture and language because we think that we have the latest and greatest, that we think that we have the epitome of culture in the world. And therefore, it has been placed in our hands. It is our responsibility to spread our culture and our language around the world, almost sort of like the English and the Americans have done. All right. And so the Greeks had settled that west coast of what is now Turkey. That was all Greek territory. And matter of fact, it was Greek territory up until about 110 years ago. And even the islands just off the coast there, you can see the faint line there, is still part of the country of Greece today. But they spoke Greek along here. This was Greek culture along here. But the further inland you went, the further east you went, you came into other cultures, other ethnic groups. You had, this was the remnants of the Lydian Empire. And they spoke Lydian, go figure. And they wanted to convert them to Greek. And so Philadelphia was actually on the frontier of where that transitioned. And it was started as a city to promote Greek language and culture. And they were successful. By 17 BC, Lydian had basically been eclipsed by Greek in that region. It was an agricultural region. But there was a reason why there were no large ancient cities in that place. There are several places around the world where the cities are new. Sometimes it's because there was no great civilization there that left a big footprint in the past. There's other times where it's just not a good place to build a city. For example, we're seeing this in the news today about the flooding of New Orleans. When the French came there and so on, the Indians were misunderstood. They told the folks, don't build there. Because it floods. It's a big bowl. And when the hurricanes come through, the bowl fills up. Not a good place to build a city. But they misunderstood and said, oh, great, thanks. And they built the city in the one place that really is not a place to build a good city. Build a city. It's easy to flood. There's a number of other places for various reasons. If you look at the country of Bangladesh, for example, in the Bay of Bengal, the part of Bangladesh that goes down to the southeast has Chittagong is a little bit inland, but there's no other cities along there. And the reason there's no other cities in this extremely densely populated country is because they are always getting blasted by typhoons. They come through there regularly, and if you live within a certain distance of the coast, you're going to get blown away and washed away. And so they have learned over the centuries, don't build there. If you want to go vacation there when the weather is good, fine, but don't stay real long, all right? You're in trouble if you do. Philadelphia, the valley where Philadelphia is, that region where it is, had no large ancient cities because this area was especially prone to earthquakes. As a matter of fact, I went online and I'm looking for pictures of ruins of Philadelphia. And if you go online and look, you'll just see a whole bunch of different pictures of this. Because that's about all there is. Partly because the city is not that old and partly because earthquakes. These are actually the supports. These were connected by huge arches at one point. This region suffered a huge earthquake in 17 AD, and a lot of the major buildings and stuff collapsed. Lots and lots of people died. The Romans, the emperor paid for the rebuilding of the city. But there were tremors and aftershocks and so on for years afterward and very frequent, sometimes daily. And the people were terrified. So they stayed in there because it got really fertile soil. became a place of vineyards and so on. But the people, instead of living in this walled city with these big, huge, mountainous brick and stone buildings, which is not the kind of place you want to be in for earthquakes, lived in tents outside of town for the most part. If there was an earthquake, everybody ran screaming out of town, out to where the tents were. Much better to live in a tent at that time. And they've had, of course, earthquakes repeatedly. If you look at the tectonic plates, the eastern part of the Mediterranean, the Aegean area has got several little ones all sort of stuck together. And this area is very, very prone to earthquakes. So Philadelphia is the smallest, the least significant of all these all the cities here. And again, not big and thriving because of earthquakes. It did great as far as agriculture. It did fine as far as commerce. But as far as buildings, anything that had any lasting impact, you're looking at it. I mean, I spent probably 30 minutes going through, and I kept getting pictures of this. Different angles, you know, and everything, just over and over and over again, this stuff. There's three of them. And it's like, well, I guess that's it. And then I'm reading different articles on the city, and yeah, well, okay, that's it. They say there isn't much in the way of ruins, and explain why. So I guess that's it. You can see where they're still doing some digging, and there was some recent stuff that was done over near the sort of Acropolis. There's a hill, but it wasn't really built upon a whole lot. So Philadelphia, a new city, a smaller city. This is actually a town of about 35,000 today, and it's a growing community there in Turkey. But not a lot as far as ancient ruins are concerned. Now, our text says, starting in verse 7 of chapter 3, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write, these things saith he that is holy, he that is true," and by the way, if he is holy, he is going to be true. These two things, you can't have one without the other. "He hath the key of David. He that openeth and no man shutteth and no man openeth." I actually come here on Sunday usually with three sets of keys. Alright, this is the key. I got a key to the church van here, and then a key to this building. And then I've got a key to our minivan, and then I've got my regular set of keys that has a house key, a back door key, an office key, and a couple of padlock keys on it. And frankly, I'm not sure what the padlocks are and where they are. I think I know where one or two of them are, but the keys sort of accumulate. Maybe you have the same sort of thing, that your main key ring accumulates keys, then you have to wonder, what in the world is that for? But the idea of a key in ancient times, they did have keys, not too dissimilar from that. But keys were often a rather convoluted and big thing. They might be something like this. And don't think of it sticking into a giant keyhole and then turning it, and then it clicks and so on. It had to do with the fact that you had a drop, all right? But they had a convoluted way of reaching in there and being able to pop the thing open. And so you had to have a board or a flattened piece of iron or bronze to slide through this thing to be able to pop the thing open. Sometimes keys were of that nature. But they did have keys very similar to this. Also in ancient times, and we still go through the ritual of this with a lot of the monarchies that are still in existence around the world. The idea of the key, or the signet, or the seal, that the king may keep this with him, keep it secret, keep it safe, or he may bestow it to a steward who is responsible for certain things. Now, I'll give you an illustration of that in the scripture. Let's go to Isaiah. So keep your finger here, and let's go to Isaiah chapter 22. And we're going to look at a passage where he's prophesying regarding the steward of Hezekiah, I believe it was. And the fellow's name was Shebna. Now, Shebna was a fellow who was always patting himself on the back, who was milking his position for everything he could get. It was a prestigious position and so on. And it talks about his fall. That he will lose his position. And then it says in verse 20, "It shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with thy robe, and strengthen him with thy girdle, that be your sash or the belt. And I will commit thy government into his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And the key of the house of David, verse 22 of chapter 22, the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder. So we're not talking about, you know, something you can stick in a pocket, not something little, but something large. So he shall open and none shall shut, and he shall shut and none shall open. And I will fasten him as a nail in a sure place and so forth. But the idea is that he is given the responsibility of opening and closing, and no one else has that privilege or right. It is bestowed upon him by the king. Now, Hezekiah could take that and do it himself, but this fellow has been given the responsibility. He has the key. And he has the key to the house of David. It is the royal key. Now, remember that Jesus is the heir to the throne of David. He is the king. When he returns, the kingdom, an earthly kingdom, will be established. He will literally rule and reign the world from Jerusalem. He is the heir to the throne of David. The throne of David is not in heaven. There's some schools of theology that teach that. I want you to understand something. David never ruled from heaven. All right? David was never king in heaven. David was king here. His throne is here. His lineage, his domain is here. David does not have a domain in heaven. He has a domain here. Now his heir will rule both places because he's God and man. But the throne of David is an earthly throne. And, so the idea there of having control over the house, the government and so on of David. And so he mentions Christ, that he has the key of David, that Jesus is indeed the king, fulfilling the Davidic covenant. He is the heir to that kingdom that will indeed be established. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. And it's talking future tense there. It's not talking about the present. It's talking about what will be. He that openeth and no man shutteth, and shutteth and no man openeth. We talk about, this is part of our Christian lingo, that we talk about open doors and closed doors, and that's exactly what he's talking about here. There's some places where in missions are closed countries, that they won't let you in, not legally, not under the not openly as Christian missionaries. For example, China. There are a number of sideways ways you can get into China to be a missionary. It's usually as an English language teacher or something of that nature. And they're more than welcome to have you come in under that way. And quite a bit of evangelism has been done that way. That's legal. But there are some countries where they won't let you in under any pretense as far as the gospel is concerned in any way, shape, or form. We deal with open doors and closed doors. He says in verse 8, I know thy works, and behold, I have set before thee an open door. And no man can shut it. For thou hast little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name. So let's pause here for a moment. God has given these folks an open door of opportunity to share the gospel, to be witnesses, to do what God has called them to do in their community there of Philadelphia. He says, you don't have a lot of strength, but you've been faithful, and so I'm going to continue to give you opportunity. One of the things you need to recognize, God usually works this way. That if God can depend on you to seize the opportunity, he'll give you opportunities. If God can trust you, here's somebody that he's working in their heart, and he wants somebody to share the gospel with them. And so he brings this person across your path, and you offer them a gospel tract, or maybe you engage them in conversation, and pretty soon things steer toward the gospel. You ask them some questions, and it just develops into a God. And God's, if you've had this experience, God, it's amazing. It's almost as if God had prepared that person and prepared the circumstances to bring us together so that this could happen. Well, guess what he did? Jeff Musgraves calls those gospel appointments. And God gives us those things primarily if he can trust us. You say, well, I've never had one of those. Well, Do you give out tracts? Do you seek to engage people in conversation and try to share the gospel? Is God going to give you these opportunities because he can count on you that you will seize them, that you will use them? Because if not, then you're probably not going to get any. It's a wasted opportunity. And for these folks here, they have been faithful. And so God has given them an open door. Continuing opportunity, continuing fruitfulness, even though they have little strength, they have kept the word and not denied my name. Now, have they suffered persecution? We're going to see in the next verse what the primary source of the persecution was. Now, we dealt with several of the others. We dealt with the idea of emperor worship. We are dealing with the end of the first century. We have a wicked and frankly demented Roman emperor by the name of Domitian on the throne in Rome. He hates Christianity. He hates the Senate. He is trying to put all power in his own hands. And the more he can promote self by emphasizing emperor worship and so on, the happier he is. And so he persecutes Christians, and you are required, remember we saw this before, you have to burn annually your pinch of incense on the altar. You're given a certificate and you're good to go for a year. You burn the pinch of incense on the altar and say, Caesar is Lord. Now Christians in good conscience were not doing that. And depending on the city, depending on the place in the Roman Empire, sometimes it was people would just look down their noses at you. Sometimes it was ignored in its entirety. They did not emphasize this this rule, this law. Some places it was totally ignored. There might not have been a local temple to the emperor, but there was a lot of them here in Asia Minor. They were trying to ingratiate themselves to the emperor, and if you wanted to be on really good terms with Rome, then you'd build yourself one of these so that Rome would like you. But there's some places where they didn't care and where it was not emphasized. And so the amount of persecution varied tremendously from place to place. There were places where it was a capital offense, and there's others where they ignored this entirely. In the city of Philadelphia, there was another source of persecution, which we see in the book of Acts. In particular, it says in verse 9, behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan. Synagogue of Satan. By the way, if you look that up, they'll often tie that in with anti-Semitism, but it's not. As a matter of fact, it's Jews persecuting Christians. This is back when the Jews very definitely had the upper hand. It says, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I make them to come and worship before thy feet and to know that I have loved thee. Now, let's flip the coin a little bit. Let's say you are a first century Jew. Let's put yourself maybe in Paul's steps before his conversion. You have a fella who believes what he has been taught. He believes the scriptures. He himself is a Pharisee. He is well taught. He is thoroughly indoctrinated. His father was a Pharisee. He believes the scripture and he also believes the traditions. And many of the Orthodox today, that's them. They believe this. They believe what has been passed on to them. They believe the promises. They believe the promise that God made to Abraham. They believe the promise that God made to David. They believe that the Mosaic covenant is still binding on their people today. They believe these things. And then Christianity comes along. And you have this man who claims to be Messiah, but as we talked about this morning, he did not fulfill all the expectations. And their conclusion, because you're left with only two options. Either the man is who he claims to be. And again, he's of the right lineage, it's the right time, the miracles, the blameless life, the resurrection from the dead. All right, those all scream as loud can be. Yeah, this is the guy. But what about the glory? What about the kingdom? What about, there's a lot of things that it just, and you can't reconcile these things if you already have certain preconceptions. And so if he's not really the Messiah, then he's a pretender. He's a fraud. And those who follow him are pulling people out of our faithful group and they're embracing heresy. That would be like having somebody come along and whisk away 20 or 30 or 40% of our congregation off to Mormonism or Islam or something of that nature. And of course we would be uptight about this. False teachers have come in and they are deceiving our people and leading them astray. That was how the Orthodox viewed Christianity. And again, if you're not seeing Jesus for who he is, that's going to be your conclusion. The Jews also were the primary target of Christians, at least at the beginning, when Paul traveled and he's going to the different cities. The first place he went was the synagogue. He is going to declare to them the fulfillment of the messianic promise. He's going to go through the scriptures step by step and show that, yes, Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise. And he is. And there would be some that believe, but the majority, after a matter of weeks, or sometimes it lasted a few months, the line would be drawn, and the believers would be basically expelled, and they would start a church, and the remainder would be hostile against that group that pulled out, because also Gentiles would start coming, and that was kind of an anathema kind of thing as well. Now, by the way, the despising of Gentiles by New Testament era Christians, which is actually spilled in even to the modern day to a large extent, although it's more subtle, is not biblical. Read Solomon's prayer of dedication regarding the temple, and he talks about Gentiles turning to the God of Israel. Read Isaiah over and over again. It talks about the Gentiles will also worship. And so this idea of our little group and the rest of you are barred from this is not biblical in the Old Testament teaching on this. But it was based on the fact that the Jews had been persecuted under the Gentile heel for so long. So it's a reaction to that. They are reacting to those who had persecuted and afflicted them for centuries. All right, which is very easy to do because, frankly, the church ended up doing that as a result of what we're seeing here right now. The synagogue of Satan. Paul makes it clear in the book of Romans that a true Jew in the eyes of God is not only someone who is a descendant of Abraham, but somebody who truly believes. You are not, in God's eyes, a Jew just by your lineage. You are a true Jew. And by the way, don't get confused here and think just because you're a Gentile believer, you have become a Jew in God's eyes. That's not the case. He's talking about believing Jews and non-believing Jews. That if you're a believing Jew, then you are a Jew in God's eyes. You're a Jew indeed. And a participant in the promises of God. And those who reject the promises and reject Jesus as Messiah have excluded themselves from being part of that promise. All right? Go back and read Romans 9, 10, and 11. That's all about that. So when he talks about the synagogue of Satan, he's talking about those who are under the name of Jew. They still have the synagogue. They still read the scriptures. But they have rejected the messianic fulfillment in the person of Jesus Christ. They have made up their minds. Jesus is not the Messiah. They have made that declaration. And they have a great hostility toward the church because this is that upstart cult. All right? That's how they perceive it. This is that upstart cult that has deceived so many of our people. And you have this one who has claimed to be our promised Messiah, but he's not because he didn't set up the kingdom. He performed miracles. He was sinless. He rose from the dead. Well, throw that one aside. The fact of the matter is he didn't do what we thought he would do when he was supposed to do it. And again, very earnest. When Jesus was talking to the disciples in the upper room discourse, he said that those who kill you will think they will be doing God service. And these folks thought that. We will kill the heretics. We will make life miserable for the heretics. We will oppose the heretics because we are defending the truth. And they're very much in earnest. And so in the city of Philadelphia, we saw this some other places as well. In Smyrna this happened. I mentioned we had the burning of Polycarp back in Smyrna. And how Polycarp was the pastor of the church there in Smyrna, and He had opportunity to flee. He had all, but he's, no, I cannot deny my Lord. And they burned him at the stake. And it was on the Sabbath. And the Jews despised Polycarp so much that on the Sabbath they went and gathered the firewood to burn him, even though it was the Romans doing the burning. Anything that they could do to help quash Christianity, anything they could do to make the lives of the Christians miserable, they would. And that was the chief point of opposition there in Philadelphia. The believers were under opposition by the Jews. Okay, it's in John chapter 16, verse 2. The time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God's service. 16:2. Understand that the Islamic persecution of Christians today is under the same guise. These folks, for the most part, think that they are doing the right thing. That we are going to honor God by slaughtering these people. This is not new to the 21st century. You go back and read what the Turks did to, not only the Armenians, they killed 1.5 million Armenians during World War I. They could have allowed them to leave. Many of them lived on the eastern coast along that Greek edge that I talked about earlier. They wouldn't let them leave. Instead, they deported them to the interior of the country where they could do what they wanted with them. They killed all the intellectuals, the people in leadership. They shot them. They took all the young men and put them, this is during World War I, and the Turks were on the other side. They were sided with the Germans. They would put them to forced labor and not feed them or give them enough water, and they would eventually die. And then the women and the children and the older folks, they would, under the guise of moving them to a different location into safety, would march them, give them forced marches, and again, not give them enough food, not give them enough water. And the end destination was to drop them off in the Syrian desert and then abandon them. And these people, they killed 1.5 million people. Hitler, in learning how to do the Jewish genocide of World War II, got his primary lessons from the Turks. He studied the Turk methods to learn how to do this. And as best, how to keep it secret, how to wipe out that number of people without letting most people know what was going on. And they did the same thing for the Greeks. Right after World War I, I mentioned that up until about 100 years ago, that western edge of what is now Turkey, still had a very large Greek population. But there was a war between the Greeks and the Turks right after World War I. And the Turks had the upper hand in that. And they slaughtered the Greeks that lived there. They killed thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Burned the cities with people inside the buildings and everything else. And finally, in reaching an agreement, it was a religious thing. It had nothing to do with what your native language was. If you were Christian, if you were Orthodox and you lived in Turkey, you were deported to Greece. And if you were a Muslim and lived in Greece, you were deported to Turkey, and they didn't exchange. The vast majority of the moving, by the way, was Greeks going from Turkey to Greece. There weren't that many Turks there weren't that many Muslims living in Greece. But this massive killing, altogether probably close to 2 million people that the Turks killed just over 100 years ago. And it was the same reasoning, the same method that we have seen in the last 10, 15 years here with ISIS and so forth. It's the exact same thing for the exact same reason. Now we look at this and we are absolutely appalled. We are horrified. And yet the people who are doing this, sometimes it's for political reasons, sometimes it's to line pockets and so on, but the root of the thing is it's a religious war. And these people are convinced that they are honoring God by slaughtering these people. Now, I will also let you know that biblically, Christians don't have that as an option. If bad behavior comes from bad theology, And we have the Inquisition and a number of these other things in history. Folks, that's bad theology. Bad theology allows us to justify bad behavior. But Christians don't have that as an option. Not true Christians, not biblically. We don't have that option. We want vengeance, we want vindication. Look at the end of our passage here, at the end of our verse in verse 9. I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, that they may know that I love thee. Here's the open door. This is actually King Jehu in the Old Testament. This is an Assyrian, from an Assyrian obelisk, and he came to pay tribute to the kings of Assyria. This is King Jehu that we read about in your Old Testament. But those who despise God's people will eventually be vindicated. God is just. And those who serve the Lord, those who embrace the truth, we will be vindicated, not by our own strength, not by our own arm, not by force. God will do it. God will do it. And of course, we know in Philippians chapter 2 that every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Whether they have embraced him as Savior or not, they will bow the knee and acknowledge who he is. There will be that. Satan himself will bow the knee and acknowledge who he is. That's Philippians 2, verses 10 and 11. What about the Jewish people? I want you to keep your finger here in Revelation. Let's go to the book of Zechariah. Now remember, the Jewish people are God's covenant people. They are not despised by God. They are God's covenant people. The promises that God made to national Israel, we talked about this a little bit this morning, will be fulfilled. There's a lot of folks that, again, bad theology. Gives bad behavior. There's a lot of folks that say, no, they rejected their Messiah. They are out of the picture. They just need to convert to Christianity and get it over with, abandon their roots because it's all done. They had their chance. They blew it. It's over with. And all the promises that God made to Israel in the Old Testament, they're just going to roll over into the church. Now, the problem, of course, is all the curses Israel still gets to keep. But the blessings will dump them on the church. I'm sorry, you can't justify that biblically. You can come up with a school with a theological formula that pushes that direction. But biblically, God's promises have to be fulfilled, as unlikely as it may seem. I mean, good grief, 200 years ago, who would have thought that there would be in the 20th century a nation of Israel again in the land, populated by Jewish people? And who knows, in another decade or two, or maybe day after tomorrow, who knows, construction of a temple. Who'd have thought that there would be a Jewish temple in the land again? Well, God said there would be. God said there would be, which means, regardless of how unlikely it may seem, doesn't matter what the contemporary situation is, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. God made promises to this people. He made promises to this nation. So let's go to Zechariah chapter 12, because there is going to come a day when their eyes will be opened. And this comes at the end of the tribulation, when Jerusalem is under siege. We are dealing with the eve or the midst of Armageddon. It says in verse 9 of Zechariah chapter 12, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, because the nations will. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. And they shall look upon me, whom they have pierced. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. And in that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo. They will see the pierced hands, the pierced sides, the thorn-crowned brow, and they will see that their Messiah was indeed Jesus. And they will grieve because for up to this point, almost 2,000 years, they have rejected the one who came and offered the kingdom. But at that time, their eyes will be opened. And in Romans chapter 11, turn quickly there. Again, I alluded to these things this morning just in passing. Romans chapter 11. And look at verse 25. 25 is where we are today. Romans 11:25 is where we are today. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part, because there's always a remnant that believes, blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles come in. But what happens when that is completed? At the end of the tribulation in verse 26, and so all Israel shall be saved. All the remnant of Israel, all those that survive till that point, there will be a national revival that happens in that day. In complete fulfillment of the new covenant there in Jeremiah 31 through 34. And so all Israel shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and he shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I take away their sins. Again, the issue is not just national promise. The root of the problem, as we talked about this morning, the issue is sin. And the sin issue needs to be resolved in order to have the rest of the promises fulfilled. I had a professor friend of mine said, what would have happened? He dealt with conjecture, the wonderful world of what if. What would have happened if in the first century Israel had repented and had embraced their Messiah and accepted Jesus as the king? You say, wouldn't that have been wonderful? Well, that creates another dilemma. Where's the sacrifice for sin? And he says the answer is very simple. The Romans would have taken him and crucified him, and the outcome would have been the same. Except that the kingdom would have been established after the resurrection. But God in his mercy, and it's an unusual thing, it's a mercy that there has been this postponement. You think, look at all this horrible tragedy that has happened over the millennia. Yes, but the gospel has gone from Jerusalem to Rome to the ends of the earth. And billions of people throughout history will be part of this kingdom. That God started with one individual, a guy named Abraham, and then that became a nation. And there were little pockets around, a little bit the Kenites and Job and his crowd and so on. But those eventually died out. But God preserved the truth. And in the Christian era, it has gone to the ends of the earth with the Great Commission. And billions of people through the centuries have come to know Christ as Savior. They are citizens of that kingdom coming. And so when we get to verse 9 back in Revelation chapter 3, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet and to know that I have loved thee. Because when Christ returns, there in Revelation chapter 19, we'll get to that, that's going to be fun and exciting. When we get to Revelation chapter 19, when Christ returns on the horse, we come with him. We are glorified at that point. We are in a glorified body. We will rule and reign with him over this world for 1,000 years. And the people who survived the tribulation, remember, there's a national revival of the Jews. The Jews that survived to the end will come into the kingdom. And all those people who come back, who have been persecuted over the years by the Jews or any other people, they will come and they will pay homage to those that their ancestors persecuted. There'll be vindication. But what's interesting is we get to that point, they're not going to be punished immediately thereafter because they have since believed. Because the grief is that I'm not going to suffer punishment. The grief is, why didn't we believe? Why didn't we believe? I have led a number of people to Christ on their deathbeds or when they were in their older years. And the lamentation has always been, why did I wait so long? Why did I wait so long? Verse 10. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I will also keep thee from the hour of temptation. The word there is the idea of tribulation, which shall come upon the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. This is, I think, a subtle reference to the pre-tribulation rapture, that the church will be removed and not have to go through the tribulation. And then he says in verse 19, behold, or verse 11 rather, behold, I come quickly. Hold fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. He that overcometh, will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more, and so forth. Let me pause and go back to verse 11. Behold, I come quickly. That is stated several times in the book of Revelation. Behold, I come quickly. This was written a little over 1900 years ago. About 1920 years ago that was written. We have been waiting. It is the doctrine of imminency. Is there anything that has to happen? Anything observable? Any prophecy that needs to be fulfilled that we can see and say, ah, it's coming, it's coming? Is there anything that needs to happen before the church is removed and this tribulation starts? No. Nothing has to happen that's observable. Well, I thought there was going to be a temple in Jerusalem and that Antichrist was going to desecrate that temple. Yes, that's true. And guess what? You can build a temple in 3.5 years. As a matter of fact, I think that one of the things that's going to be taking place at the very outset of the tribulation is you're going to have Islam is going to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Neutralized. And will no longer be a force to be dealt with. I think that Antichrist's allegiance with Israel is going to be together against Islam. Because unless Islam is crushed as a movement, they can't build their temple. Moshe Dayan, they controlled the Temple Mount in 1967, and the Temple Faithful wanted to build a mountain. He says, or build the temple. He says, no, you can't do that. We have barely gotten by against Syria and Egypt and Jordan. And if we tore down the Dome of the Rock, then we'd have to be dealing with Pakistan and Indonesia and Saudi Arabia and all the rest of them. And we can't do that. That has to stay, at least for now. And so all these things have to eventually take place, but they don't have to take place before the church is gone. There is nothing that has to take place before the rapture. It could happen before I finish my next sentence. Nothing has to happen first, as far as that's observable. God has certain time things on his timetable, but they're known only to him. And the idea of when is tied to the rapture, because the thing that is unknown is not the rapture itself. It's when does the tribulation start? And I think that the starting of the tribulation and the rapture are probably very close to being simultaneous events. But the actual starting of the tribulation is not the rapture, but rather Israel's treaty with Antichrist. That's what starts the countdown for the 70th week. And that's in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Verse 12, very quickly. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall no more go out and come in. In Philadelphia, in the city of Philadelphia, they had a... something kind of like, you see our version of this down at the library. All right, if you went to the farmer's market yesterday morning, my wife and I did. I think it's only the second time I've gone this year, but we go down to the farmer's market, walk down the library, and they have this this brick pathway. And they also have these concrete or stone books sitting there, and there are certain names inscribed. You go down to the Pike Market, you have the same thing, names on the bricks and so on. And those are people that contributed for the building of this this building or this plaza or whatever the case may be. In ancient Philadelphia, if you were being honored for some great civic contribution, they would chisel your name into one of the major columns of the principal temples there in town. And so you were honored. It's kind of like having a statue of Ezra Meeker downtown, you know. You got your name there. You're an honored citizen because your name is on that list. Or you go to McDonald's, you know, employee of the month, you know, same idea. And so he uses the thing that is there locally that the people there in Philadelphia would be familiar with. The names written on the chiseled into the pillars of the temple. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God. Which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down from heaven, out of heaven from my God. And I will write upon him my new name. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Any additional questions or comments or anything dealing with this section on the city of Philadelphia? Let me see if I had another picture or anything, or is this was it? Anything else? All right, let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you. Thank you for the promises that you have made. Thousands of years ago, 4,000 years ago for some of them. And Father, they all must come to pass. They all must be fulfilled as you gave them. Father, may we trust in you. May we trust in your word. Father, thank you for some of what took place 2,000 years ago, that Christ came to bear our sin, that we might have forgiveness. But when he comes again, it'll be to establish the kingdom. Father, thank you that if we have trusted Christ, we are citizens of that kingdom, and we will rule and reign with you for 1,000 years. Father, thank you for what you've done. Father, may we hold fast, awaiting that time, we pray, for Christ's sake. Amen.